Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU Libraries, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this evening's reading. Thank you for coming out on such a cold evening. I'm really delighted that you're here, and I think we're in for a real treat, so thank you. Tonight's guest is Deanne Lundeen. She lives currently in Ann Arbor, Michigan. She received her MM from the Eastman School of Music and her MFA from the University of Michigan. Deanne Lundeen is the author of a poetry collection, The Ginseng Hunter's Notebook, published by New Issues Press in 1999. Her work has also appeared in Painted Bride Quarterly, The Kenyon Review, Prairie Schooner, and other literary journals. While a lecturer at the University of Michigan, she developed an instructional website using the poetry archives at the Bentley Historical Library as an introduction to research in special collections. Born and raised in Florida, Deanne Lundeen has lived in Boston, Oklahoma, Los Angeles, and Wales, and finds the theme of place important to her writing. As Americans, I think we hunger for a place of our own, she writes. So much of what means America has to do first with a pastiche culture drawn from everywhere, like English itself, and now with a pop culture that erases or at least blurs any sense of where and what one is. The Ginseng Hunter's Notebook explores in part how place infects us and cures us, how much the American imagination both longs for and tries to escape an identity rooted in place. Ms. Lundeen has taught at the University of Michigan and at UCLA. A Hopwood winner in both essay and poetry, she is presently at work on a historical novel set in 17th century Suriname, which I just found out is not in Asia but is in South America, and a memoir about growing up adopted and unexpectedly meeting her birth mother in the last few years. Please join me in welcoming Deanne Lundeen.
As usual, I would really like to meet myself. I love introductions. They always make you feel like you're, wow, I didn't know that. That's kind of neat. I'm pretty much going to stick to the Ginseng Hunter's Notebook. I have a few poems that I might get to that are more recent, but I figured if anyone has had a chance to look at the book, this is what they will have seen. So I will just begin without any more ado. There will be some that I'll have to introduce to you, but this one I don't think so. Shaker Dance. The visitor pushes the gate and it disappears into a blue shade through which dazzle slants in sharp white lines like envy. He arrives in his black box looking for exits. So much space offends him. Here we tilt away from the world in a different gravity where motion does not complete. So far, we do not lie down but square our bodies to the ultimate task. We keep the soul from flying off on its string of light, though the strain pulls us up a little each day. Gesture becomes us. A knot of fire undoes the hand and it opens. The shears dip and flash, and a green smell rises into the rolled up morning's oblique news. In a little while, the body will unfold in all its senseless and extravagant delight, which to the visitor will seem like silence, silence and arrested motion. We call this grace. Where the soul is. Descartes kept his in the pineal gland, safe and convenient, even when traveling. He always knew where he was. Freud wasn't sure, but felt something unusual in the penis and thought at once of wanderers haunting the steps, women keening the soul that flew out of them, so many exits you could not guard them all. Some keep their souls in clay jars, the scent of ground cumin and cinnamon spitting in oil, or like Yeats, in a smell of invisible violets. It lurks in a tub of laundry, in Emerson's eye. Socrates thought it had something to do with dryness, thinking perhaps of Lethe, or maybe the weight of light, his soul never happy, twisting itself in a question, kicking its legs. They say Baudelaire kept his in a bottle of wine. Picasso hacked and slashed and tore to let it out. And Beethoven's lived in his ear, Just think of those terrible years of separation. Or was it enclosure? Private garden, festive little parties for two as he roared, singing through the fields. A farmer heard him coming, stunned for a moment. Was this the devil at last coming to claim? And quickly dropped his soul, seed by seed, into its rich black holes, just in case. The divine Miss D kept hers in a tiny box. Like Beethoven, there were two of them, tea and a crumb of blood. But she had that window. A woman's soul can always get out. I used to think my soul was gnomish, home in its hollow stump under the bridge, its sign at the crossroads. Then for a time, the killing pace of her long legs covering tundra, hungry and sharp. But last night, I heard her tiny hooves clatter in a panic of glee down the dividing street, dim, far shriek of tea. If you love something, it's time, say the clocks, and empty, say the baskets. The lamp says, too hot, but I never let her go. She leaves when she wants to, lives where she can. She never tells me anything. The genesis of this book was a little sequence of poems I was working on called Herbal Remedies. I was always taken with the sort of idea that you could cure anything with an herb if you found the right one. So I had a lot of fun playing with that. And I thought I would read this particular poem, which sort of is the frontispiece to that, because Valentine's Day is coming up and it's sort of a love poem. In the roof garden, starved blossoms stage a comeback. Drift of langostina climbs the stairs. I forget burnt mornings, caffeine-starched and plumed vociferous days. I want to be calm about this. I want to be fair. I name each pot a remedy. Plausible, blemish, catch, insight. Rosemary flares its tiny stash of blue as if blue were an easy thing anyone could do. Jewel of disasters, my sweet calamity, you are futures trading themselves for a past, unlocking its luggage and scattering all of it in the street, a clamor of yellow and white, traffic pumping its flammable blood at the light, a fury and stench of sadness dressed in joy, and without you I have no peace. Poppies hum in electric reds, light-hearted means we see that way through music, distant and too close to hear without. Poppies listen as the day shuts down and all things tilt toward difference, which is not distinction. Poppies sway a little this way and that. They know how much we want to be deceived, brilliantly and without pity, and so sometimes it pleases them to tell the truth. A few have heard them singing and keep it to themselves. Red is not difficult. Everyone believes in red, and so the heart sways a little this way and that, and is comforted. I want to say a couple of words about this poem. I hate long introductions, but I'll give you just a few words. This is a poem that is in the voice of a woman writing in 1736. She was married to a man who was a bit of a problem. He was not only improvident, but managed to get himself into even more hot water after she managed to get them out of financial crisis because he went to Sweden and got caught plotting to change the succession and of him. So before that happened, though, she was somebody who drew quite a lot, and she was sort of an early-day botanist. But of course, women weren't, right? So she went to the Society of Apothecaries garden in London and, in fact, lived there for a little bit in a little house where she was drawing and painting and made something like 500 plates for a beautiful illustrated herbal. And she sold that. That was how she got them out of the financial crisis. So this is in her voice. Fig. Elizabeth Blackwell to Alexander Blackwell, September 1736, the Society of Apothecaries Garden. My love, though you have driven me to such intemperate means of living apart from you, almost in exile, among herbs and plants of physic, I do bless your poor habits with such poor praise as best I can in early morning pilgrimage to cut new purses, fat and green, among my plants. My little house in Swan Walk seems to me the kindest reference to my gosling state on point of transformation. A lady once of no ambition, now my secret heart flares to green fire, my philosopher's stone alive, new buds, and shortly now new fruit. Oh, see how changed I am. That mix of things seems no more curious than the muddy spring from which decay we blossom. Dear Blackwell, your dainty girl's a dirty one. This day one fool said, my lady apothecary, as I passed, all in contempt, but I bowed and smiled sweetly. A fig, if I may say. And so I chose this afternoon to draw the charming fig, and find a perfect five-point leaf spread like a bright concealing hand across the secret places of our lives, and, if we've heard the story right, across the secret places of our first parents. But lest you think I do descend too far, remember, had she never sinned, Eva never had been Ave. These things I thought as I slit open one ripe purple fig, the wrinkled purse of its velvet skin filling the palm of my hand, its sticky seeds, so many, packed so close together, it seemed I held the fruit of paradise and felt my woman's spirit rise and eat. In doing research for this book, I looked at a lot of old herbals and read a lot of very interesting stuff. And one of the people I discovered was a woman named Maria Sibylla Marion, and she is the person who has become the centerpiece of the novel I'm working on, 17th century Suriname, which is on the north coast of South America, not too far from Trinidad. And it is the site of the notorious description in Candide that Voltaire makes of slave culture. And it was, you know, we think about plantation slavery, how terrible it was in the southern United States, but Suriname was worse, far worse. And it was, under the Dutch, probably the worst that it got to be. So she traveled on her own at the age of 52, which at that time, of course, was pretty advanced, and she had to pay for everything herself. She sold her collections she had put together for years, her own paintings. She wasn't going on an expedition the way a man would have gone, you know, paid to be part of somebody's expedition. She just had to do it, and she wanted to, so she did, and she went and stayed 2 years, took one of her daughters, who also became an artist, ended up at Peter the Great's court later, teaching. Nearly died, because many Europeans did, going to South America. We left our diseases and nearly died. Seems fair. But anyway, she did quite a lot of work there, and in fact, her major book was Metamorphosis Insectorum, meaning the, you know, insects who go through change. And many of the things that she painted were there. I discovered her on a postage stamp. That's where I first found her. So as far as erudite research, that was where I first saw her. And then, of course, I went and found out more about her. But it was such a beautiful image that I wanted to know more about her. And so I wrote this particular piece, which is a guzzle called Suriname. Maria Sibylla Marion, artist on a 1699 expedition to Suriname. Dolphins cleave the uncut waters, green as jade from Suriname. They send me this vision. All roads lead away from Suriname. Not morning yet, I walk the sea-sprayed deck, a brush that swells with wet and thunderous grays, too far from Suriname. Do you think loss is only personal? No doubt it is. I crouch on Swedish rocks, I gather bitter waves from Suriname. In the studio, sick and pale, I cut and eat a crust of scarlet kept for fevers, chills, and blindness, in short, in case of Suriname. Nothing works. My daughter's dull, the servant's deaf, and I am mute because my thoughts are phrased in Suriname. I copy leaves that burn, entanglements of tendrils, fronds along the sea-shed sand, creased like a letter. It arrives, erased from Suriname. Faint wash of sky. You shrug, your coat seems tight. Come close, no, closer. Ah, you see, like that, the palm trees sway in Suriname. Words fall dead as money. Pocket of grief, stain of joy. On the pure page, shrubby scratches. There is no place called Suriname. So now, Maria, Sibyl of Christians, choose the colors, saffron, lapis, cochineal, which tell, like news heard in a shell, the days of Suriname. When I die, you will see I told the truth. Unfold the skin, unwall the heart. You'll find it burning still, the way to Suriname. I was asked a question in the little interview that we had before by Michael Rodriguez about Michigan and what Michigan has to do with, you know, your writing and how long you've been here and that sort of thing. And as I said to him, I think wherever you are, the place pretty much leaches into your nervous system. But I find that I actually, as much as I found it difficult to live in L.A., my imagination thrived on the surrealism of Los Angeles, the impossibility of it all. You know, it's like living in a big motherboard. And there are beautiful things about Southern California, which I did like. But I really liked that aspect of it. It was bizarre. I felt very much as if I turned sideways, I'd disappear. I mean, you just feel like you're painted on something. And I lived on a hill where I could look out every day and see the Hollywood sign, you know what I mean? I was like, hello? It was very much like a personal message, you know, Hollywood. It was, and a lot of people come there because that's exactly how they feel, you know. There's something kind of quintessentially both American and also just, you know, you can't call it American. It's like the new world arriving on our shores, and it keeps coming. And you sort of feel like, you know, the West Coast is where all the weird stuff happens first, and then it percolates, you know. By the time it gets to Michigan, you know, it's normal. So I guess that was part of my experience, was being at sort of in a place where you really felt like weirdness was coming in with every wave, and it was normal. It was just normal. The sort of postmodern condition, I think, was born in Los Angeles. So I wanted to read a couple of poems that are kind of from that landscape. Orange Bang. April's a hat made of rain and an anchor of cloud. The Santa Monica Sea waves goodbye and goes back to its sewing. I bought a small quilt by the pier. It was covered with ants bearing needles. Some of us feel this way and some of us that, but mostly otherwise. He said, just who do you think you are? And I said, exactly. They sent me a small brown scrap as the proof that my box had exploded. Such an agreeable color, like snails sliding over leaves. I have reassembled my life in another body, one without sin, in another city, inside a tunnel of wind. In this direction. This is a beautiful country. I have not cast my eyes over it before, that is, in this direction. John Brown, on the way to his execution, December 2nd, 1859. Blossom and Meg take the Hollywood line, two girls heading west. The American dream's gone funny somehow. Blossom, in green fatigues and cowboy boots, has that pinched look around the waist as if God, feeling peevish, was closing his fist when it seemed more amusing, a nice twist to make Blossom a man with expensive tastes in nylon and hats. Across from our bus stop at Parkman and Sunset, two cops have arrested a black man who wanted, I remember, a double espresso and make it quick. A middle-aged king in exile, he stands there, maybe thinking of how long it will be, years of thin, burnt water, refuting the very idea of coffee while they snap on the cuffs. Meanwhile, Meg is happy just to be seen with Blossom on a trip, with the rapt fan's attentive crossing of legs, the cigarette flicked with a casual consequence, wet lips pursed. But she'll never get that perfectly bored expression only the rich can acquire, the ones who have already met desire and passed through, possibly wiser, free to take any direction. I'm going to read a little small portion from, and it's just a paragraph, don't panic, from a memoir that I'm working on to introduce the next poem, because it is, I'm going to be reading some poems that are referencing the meeting with my birth mother and so on. So I'll read this little bit as an introduction. I was surfing the web one day looking for my mother, and I found what I should have expected but didn't. The home pages of all the other people who don't know who they are and are hoping someone out there in suburbia might tell them. And what could be more American? It turns out there's hundreds of thousands of us. Being adopted may even be the single cultural experience we're all sure we share. Mom, am I adopted? Jimmy says I'm adopted. And while for most kids, Jimmy gets grounded for making you feel bad, for me the answer was yes, your mother made a mistake. So I begin to have a certain intimacy with errors, because I owed my existence to a mistake. This poem has little sections that are just headed by a single word, and it's interesting, this particular poem, how it happened. I was basically cruising around in the Oxford English Dictionary because it's fun, and looking up adoption, you know, and seeing what it had to say there, and the history of the world, its the word, its etymology, and so on. And then I went to write a little bit and was trying to find adoptions, and so on, and ended up with a program that hadn't been really filled in yet, and so it simply didn't know what I meant by adoption. And it kept querying, you know, do you mean this? Or maybe you mean this other thing. And so I don't get it. So that's how this happened. Lycos search. Adoptions not found. Replace with adopt. Latin se aliqui adoptari obsolete. We are made sons of God by adoption, as chickens are hatched at Grand Cairo by the adoption of an oven. Thus, we have adopted the modern German names of several rocks and minerals as gneiss, hornblende, quartz, and nickel. The spirit itself, that is, the spirit of adoption, which Christians receive, is one witness, I had rather adopt a child than get it. To approve, to confirm then, I propose that the report and accounts be adopted, which words must depend for their adoption on the suffrage of futurity. Latin fac Roman Romus adopted, as Ovid says, obsolete, or as Holland, when he read Pliny in 1601, fit one vine stalk to the other, joining pith to pith, and then binding them fast together so close that no air may enter between, until such time as the one hath adopted the other. Adorn with pictures? Now, according to the 1959 reprint of a 1934 translation of De Materia Medica, which presents a Greek work of the first century as understood in Hampshire in the 1500s, illustrated by a Byzantine artist in AD 512, for presentation to the daughter of Anicnisius Olybrius, who was emperor of the West in 472, the drawings learned from originals, not far removed from sketches by the famous Critias, whose plant descriptions are occasionally quoted in the text. We are less likely to invent than to mistake. Adore? And so I bless the Nestorians who first believed in error that the Son of God was only by adoption. And I bless the pictures which, as Pliny warns, are deceitful in representing such a number of colors, and especially representing the lively hue of herbs according to their nature as they grow. No marvel if they that limbed and drew them out did fail and degenerate from the first pattern and original, and as in error they misunderstood the wanderings of each plant, for they change and alter their form and shape every quarter of the year, depending on the place in which the root of their deviance may be found. Adulterate? And I bless the figures which seem hopeless of interpretation, for they are printed in the hope that field botanists, when traveling in the special localities whence the Dioscoridian flora was derived, may thus recognize a few of the plants which, through mistaken features, it has been impossible to identify in an herbarium of dried plants. For so these imperfect identifications stimulate by their falsity and production of a revised version. And I bless the Gnostics, also adoptionists who formed in error the division of the cosmos into spiral chambers reached by strange enchanted turnings between light and darkness, stairs that wind the spirit up its thread. And I bless the woman who believed herself incapable of love and so chose for herself the sergeant whose red hair burnt her husband to a crisp when she mistook him as my father, for I have no father and have never had. And thus I bless the air which fills my body in its rising and descent, and I adore the strange digressions of my life adorned with pictures from the error of her ways. I'd like to read another small bit from the memoir. And this is just about looking at a photograph. And this is after I had gone out to California and met her for the first time. On salvation. She tells me about that summer after I was born, and the nurses showed me to her. A healthy little girl, you made the right choice. No, no, you better not hold her. It's easier that way. You'll forget in time. It was not easier. She did not forget. That summer she went with a man whose name I don't know to the Jacksonville beach. I think maybe he needed to be somebody's savior. The Salvation Army took him in, and he went out looking for women who needed a man to protect them and their unborn babies, babies for which he was not responsible but wanted to be, I guess. So when my mother was desperate to get lost from the man she'd followed to Tampa, a man who'd repeatedly beaten the child she already had, who laughed at her terror, who said when she swore she was leaving, "You can't go anywhere. I know where you live." The man who was my father. She found the Salvation Army, and they found, oh, let's call him Mr. Thomas. Why not? Mr. Thomas was a businessman in Jacksonville with a job and a place for my mother to stay. Here's the two of them posed on the hot sand with a donkey. Why a donkey? I can't figure out why anyone would ever pay for a picture on the beach where a donkey was involved, unless it happened to be Acapulco or a porn joke. But it was just Florida, with nothing colored sand on a nothing beach where nothing ever happened, except in pictures like this where something extraordinary keeps on happening whenever you look. He holds the donkey's reins awkwardly tight, as if she might be carried away and flung into the ocean which curls in the distance behind her. The extraordinary thing that's happening isn't the ocean or the act of holding a donkey. It's all happening in his face. Look at it. Soft with a kind of tender fierceness. I've seen that expression on boys who are with a girl they've just realized they're in love with, and men who are with a woman who makes them feel like they're 17 again. A strange kind of tender fury and elation and terror and tensile readiness to do anything she asks, steal a fat tourist's wallet or make the late night run for the last train to Tallahassee or Tulsa or Barcelona. Who was that Victorian statesman who kept trying to save the horse? I think he's like that. He gets to be God to the unwed mothers, a vicarious father who's not left holding the baby, just the reins of a donkey on the Jacksonville beach where the empty mother sits. He might be her lover, I'm saying, but he's not. And I think she feels that rush of affection that women feel for men who could have had them but didn't. She's sitting alone up there in a grief so pure it dazzles. The thinness of that moment dazzles. I am astounded by the rootlessness of my life, adrift in a crib somewhere in the children's home society, and I think how Niels Bohr was probably right, and there is no deep reality, only a hemorrhage of light in a world stretched like a skin, thin crust of earth, a gossamer sky, and this skinny picture of me without me in it. Him for a birth mother. She is the voice in the wilderness crying. She is not prepared. She is the shadow of legs crossing the light like a fan. She is the ultraviolet message to bees. She is on her way. She is the neon hinge of night. She is the window closing. She is the lawn chair's last warm curve. She is the one who looked back. She is the mouth forming O. She is the panic of waves. I am the tongue that will lick her clean. I am the wound that will not grieve. I am the broken needle in her arm. I am the light that travels too slowly to see. I am the hiss in the sand. I am the red stone considering fire. I am the circle she walks inside. I am the crow that walks there with her. I am the sidewalk telling news. I am the crooked sign on the last hotel that says no. I am the one that got away. This poem is for my maternal grandmother that I never met. So it's kind of hard to know how to refer to her in any other way, my birth grandmother or something. It is a reference to the way my family grew up, which was pretty much Scrabble dirt poor in California. Whole. Her hands raw in the wound up day sprung loose, that baffled whir of time she ignores, easy as a once aching tooth dangling on a thread. God, Myrtle! And she just smiled, digging out onions. Another hole never hurt nobody. Which might explain how a place so flat and basically holeless could get to be called a hole, as in no water hole, dust hole.
black hole of whatever, the whole enchilada of holes. And so it was a kind of mission to make a few more holes for the relief of other folk trapped in this two-dimensional, pitiless cartoon of a hole nothing but gophers and onions could ever get out of. Not even the daughter who stands there like a worn-down penny in the last rub of light, saying, "I gotta get out of here. I want my own life," saying, "I want to be something." So she don't even look up at the bite of that hole going in, because no matter what, she knows she won't be left here for long all alone with six babies and two half-grown, because sometimes what seems like an empty hole turns out to have plenty going for it after all. And anyway, she thinks, turning the black dirt over and punching a place for the seed, that's the way of holes. Sometimes you stand there for a long time at the edge before dropping a stone to see how far. But the girl ain't that kind. She won't fall through. She's the kind so afraid of the hole she'll carry it everywhere, shooting up in her chest like an onion, pungent and thin, till they smell her coming and know she's a child of the hole, until dread finally rivets her gaze and she learns to dig. I think I'm going to choke first. I'm going to read one more poem and then give some time for people to ask all those questions. I know we're scintillating back there. All the stuff that you can then write about when you go to your class and report me. Anyway, okay. The ginseng hunter lies down in a meadow. I love the sky, which is not the color of grief. If there was an argument, it is an old argument. Sky carries on with itself and has nothing to do with us. It says nothing of the life I was going to live back then before I understood there is no future, only a kind of forward wash carried out of the last act I thought could be changed in time to prevent its arrival. When sky is this confused, we call it rain and go in for the day. Among its stars, not one fails for lack of vision, its light rubbed thin on a cinder block, only another long, narrow box for keeping us out of each other's lives as if all it took were walls. Stars fall out of their places because it is time to go, but nobody locks the door behind them or sends on the mail. Sky rearranges no mirrors and tells no lies about what it was thinking when you met its gaze for the last time over coffee and foam, which obscured the muted underlight of the throat swallowing. The sparrow has no more space than the hawk to dive and roll, and sky touches neither, but hovers there, distant and still imperceptibly present. Though if you have enough little bits of sky heaped together, it glows or streaks or ignites without purpose. Sky can be wounded, but does not heal like the skin we mistake it for. There is a language of moisture and heat, but when sky makes a point, it does not invite dialogue. I love the sky, which takes no prisoners. It kills like an elephant no longer able to restrain its itch, and so whole jungles and villages are trampled in something that looks like rage, but is only relief. For sky does not roll itself up, or reveal a long, sweet curve of leg emerging from water, neither stretching nor leaning nor any other thing the leg may do. And so we search the sky daily for signs of our lost selves, as if so much indifference must surely hide something, and where else could all that feeling have gone? But sky isn't even indifferent. It tells us no more than the wind, which is not the sound of something tearing a long way off, or a cough, or a sigh of bewilderment. The sky I love is the sky that is not suffused with faith, or delusion, or joy, or poignant arousal shaped like a new understanding of sadness. And this is the sky I look for now without ceasing, the way ivy creeps toward the light. But to tell you the truth, I have yet to see it. Thank you. So, are there any questions? I want to give a little time to people who want to ask any questions about anything, life, the universe, and everything. The answer is 44, wasn't it? No, 42. Oh, my God, I nearly gave the wrong answer. No? Yeah, oh, what?
How do you find time for all your projects?
I don't. You just keep moving them from the back burner, you know, and when one, like, gets burnt, then you move it and then start another. Yeah, keep them boiling, basically.
And how do you revise?
How do I revise? Oh, God, the revision question. The revision question. Well, you know, actually, some poems I don't. Like Hole was just, like, it just went, it was there. Other poems, you know, sometimes it's cut and paste. Sometimes you have an image that you like or a line that really begins well, and you say, okay, but it's derailed here. So sometimes literally, you know, you can print it out and just cut that part of the poem off and start again. Or you can cut it up and you start rearranging and see that it maybe a different sequence is better than the thing your brain came up with in the first place. You know, because you get into that sort of irritable mode where you sometimes pressure a poem, you know, and you put too much, like it has to make sense right away, right now. It has to be like prose. So that's another way to revise. And then, of course, there's just the good old niggling kind of work when you're working on something like a sonnet or you're working in a form and you know it's just, oh, God, it sounds like tin there. It sounds like somebody just kicked a bucket. I don't know what it is, but it's wrong. And so either the sound or the image or something has to give. So it depends on what's most important in the particular poem.
So do you think the music helps a lot? Because I'm sitting here listening to these not for the first time,
You know, it's a funny thing. I think that music is important to me in a like bone level. It's not like I write with music on. In fact, I don't, because I think the music of words themselves, I get very distracted by, you know, I mean, music is not background for me. Music is like you listen to it. So I could maybe listen to a piece and then I turn it off. And so that may jumpstart me. But it's interesting. It's a good question because some people, it's a really good thing to do with students in a class, in a creative writing class, you know, where you play music and say, okay, you know, write something, and you give them some kind of pointed exercise. But I find in that case that it's actually much easier to work with a story than to work with, if you work with poetry, then the two things just start fighting. Yeah.
Can you talk about your background in music?
Sure. How has it affected my... Well, okay. I went into music actually from having been a kid who wrote songs all the time. And so eventually, you know, when I got to the place where I wanted to do a master's, that was still what I focused on.
That was
songwriting, arranging. My degree is not, but I spent all my time, you know, doing that. Anytime I wasn't working on performance or... you know, something directly relevant to my degree, I was working on what mattered to me, which was writing songs. And I wrote lyrics for a lot of other people. There was a pretty big music theater contingent, opera, and jazz. So the people that I hung out with were people who were very creative, and we were making stuff all the time. And so I guess it was a natural segue. Lyrics I really like and are fun, but for me, I can tell you a little anecdote. I got into what's called the ASCAP Music Theater Workshop in New York with somebody that I was collaborating with on an original musical with Stephen Sondheim and Charles Strauss. So he was like, oh my God, you know, so we got critiqued by these guys, you know, we're like up on the stage with Stephen Sondheim, I nearly died. And he said something that at the time I found so devastating, but afterwards I thought, God, I think he's right. And, you know, I had some line in a song which was, then there's the sun like a yellow peach just hanging from the sky, you know, and I worked with this metaphor, you know. And the music was fabulous. I didn't write the music. The music was gorgeous, you know. But he said, you know, we have a poet working here. And at the time, of course, I was devastated because it was like, ugh, you don't want that. No, that's not what you want. No. And so I, you know, ripped my hair out for a long time, but then I realized that he's probably right. I was getting tired of getting, you know, I was feeling constricted in what you needed to do with song. I've gone back to writing some songs again, and, you know, it's a different genre. It's a very different genre. I mean, you don't want to be, I mean, unless you're, you know, in 1935 or 44 or something, you know, you're not writing these tight little around on themselves convoluted lyrics that have like a million internal rhymes and stuff. Which is what I, you know, I loved that stuff. So, of course, I was doing that, and people were like, Errol Sneed, Joni Mitchell, somebody else maybe. So I guess that was a segue also that I looked for poems to set also. And so I guess the words and the music were always together for me. But composition, okay, when you look at structure and you think about structure and form of any kind, will always transfer, you know, the sense of what is a blues form? You know, what's a 12-bar blues? You know, where do the changes happen and why? You know, and what is something like what's a pedal point? You know, it's a hinge point. It's a note that means one thing in one key and it takes on a different meaning in another. So those kinds of things. Counterpoint, of course, different voices. I mean, you can see that. I like very much like working with different discourses. So I guess you would say, yeah, structurally, it did make a big difference to me, but not in the sense that people say, you know, Yeats is musical. I mean, that's a music that I admire. That's a different kind of music. It's in the language itself. It's the, you know, the iambs and the trochees and you know, in the right order, and the vowels and the consonants. I mean, it's without being, you know, ever knowing that that's what's going on. It's, so I guess I admire the kind of poetry that you hear and you, it's so almost transparent, rolls over you, and it isn't until you really look at it that you find, oh my God, that's incredibly crafted. It sounds like someone's just talking to me. How did they do that? You know, I think Seamus Heaney does that with sonnets. You just feel like, you know, somebody is just in a pub talking to you. And then you actually look at it on the page and you go, oh, my God, it's a damn sonnet. It's perfect. Yeah, and so I like working with forms. I still like playing with them. But I mentioned that as something that I admire. I don't think I write that way. I mean, I wish I did. I'm like, I get too excited about, like, playing with the structure, I guess. And the surface is fun to me. So that's a long-winded answer. Yeah.
Who are the people you worry about sounding like?
Ha! People I worry about sounding like. Everybody has them. Who are the people you're terrified of sounding like?
Yeah, who maybe almost. Oh, I like these people too much. And,
yeah.
And I'm afraid they're creeping into my work.
Actually, almost anybody that I hear read that I really, really like you, Josie. I mean, I worry about you guys all the time.
Yeah, everybody has kind of recurring.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Jory Graham would be one for me because of her interest in the same kind of metaphysical discourse, okay? I mean, that's where she did, you know, materialism, look at materialism, right? And I like her. I am a poet of rhetoric. I mean, that is what I like to do, gestures, you know, structure and working with that. So, and she's very much about that. So I, you know, I'm awfully glad I didn't go to Iowa. I would have just been fighting with her all the time, you know. She, you know, like I could, right, you know, take the heavyweight Jory Graham on, but I would have tried. A little bantam rooster. Yeah, so that's a good question. You know, who are you most worried about sounding like? I don't know that I worry too much about sounding like too many people. I sometimes worry that I'm talking too much about the same kinds of things, maybe. Paisley in the program. Paisley Brechtel is somebody who also graduated from the University of Michigan program, constantly makes me neurotic because I'll talk to her and she'll be thinking about and writing the same thing that I'm thinking about writing. We haven't talked for like a year, you know, and I'm like, hey, that's my idea. Get out of it, you know. And obviously, you know, you get these things from the air, right, if you're attuned to the same kinds of things. And we have a very similar background. She did a lot of study and work in medieval. She's also loves the British Isles. You know, I mean, we have a lot of things in common that makes it natural for us, you know, and we love kind of hot, cliched language. We love pop culture and, you know. So, yeah, we find each other all the time, like in this... Get off my zone, man. What is it? What are you doing? Like publishing the book, you know, and I'm just now working on it. That's my subject. And you got to throw it away. You know, that's the terrible thing. So I don't, did you have another question? You
said? Yeah, I just wanted to ask about the Bentley Project.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that actually, I wouldn't say that I'm working on it. I would say that it's something that I'm going to go back to because it was a project that it was a collaborative project at the university. And it meant the English department and the Bentley Historical Library and the Humanities Text Initiative. So there were tech people and literature people and historical people and, you know, special collections people all got involved in this. And then I was sort of the one that kind of did all the work and was putting it all together. And it was a fascinating project. We just started out with the idea of let's do something that will introduce young researchers to, or just anyone who's new to researching in special collections through the medium of poetry. Because, of course, there's loads of poetry in special collections, but it's not in books of poetry. You know, you can't just go to the shelf and go, you know, oh, it's the poetry section. I mean, it's written in people's journals and diaries and in letters they send to people. It was a natural form of expression for people, and a lot of it is awful. But it's fabulous in the sense that people reached out for that. You know, I mean, dairy farmers, you know, in their account books are writing poems. It was just, you know, it was mind-blowing to see the souls of people that are doing something else, and they're maybe not all that educated, and they need poems, you know? They need it. So they write down everything they can remember, and then they make them up. So I discovered a journal by a young woman named Anna Hoyt. And it was a fabulous, it became the whole centerpiece of the collection because it in and of itself was about special collections research because it was essentially a hardbound composition book, very like you would see today, except it was, you know, harder cardboard, little swirls on it, you know. This was like Civil War era, 1864, you know. And she wrote on the inside of that cover, you open it up and the first thing you see, your eye falls on this little kind of, you know, lopsided balloon, and it says, "My name is Anna Hoyt. I am 8 years old," you know, in big, square, blocky letters. And then you look at the book, and it is full of many, many different hands, because it started out, as you look at the book, and you begin to deduce what happened, because we had very little information, almost none. It was picked up at an estate sale or something. Nobody knew where it had come from. So we had to figure all this stuff out, and I thought, my God, this is a perfect illustration of how you do this. So you look at the book, and you see, well, it begins with a bunch of poems written in this beautiful cursive hand. A Civil War soldier had written his poems in that journal, and that was probably the first writing in that journal. He then sold it to Anna's father. Anna then brings it back and starts using it for accounts on the farm. Right, you know, they don't have a lot of paper and stuff, and then she's learning to write, and so she discovers this journal, and I guess he gave it to her, you know, go ahead, you can practice your writing in here. And so you see her write her first poem when she's 12 in this journal, and then you see little other anecdotes and exercises, and, you know, she starts keeping a little diary, and then she also, as she grows older, keeps accounts in it as well. So it's just an amazing welter of slice of life.
How did you find it?
I mean, looking for poetry. There was just slogging through archives, using, you know, special finding aids and so on. You know, people knew that there was poetry in various places, but no one had ever really looked at it, You know, you don't have time to do that when you're cataloging. So you're just like, oh, yeah, those poems, whatever, you know, and on to the next 45 books, you know. So, yeah, that was one of the reasons also we thought it would be a really good introduction to show people how you work in special collections, which is partly with finding aids, you know. So we did, what we did, I'll just quickly finish here, put up a something that was on the web, you know, an online instructional thing where you click through and you look at. I mean, we had these fabulous images made of, you know, state-of-the-art imaging so that you could actually see very good images of the page. And, you know, that kind of thing has been around now for, what, 3, 4, or 5 years, and so it's not as exciting. At the time, it was, you know, there wasn't much like that. And I think it's fabulous that that's going on, that there are just huge archives now. The things you can find online are just, I find, astonishing. The, you know, the Bartleby Project and the, you know, my God, there's, you know, big projects like that. So that particular, like all websites, you know, they have to be maintained and they have to be, you know, in any way it would have to be completely revamped at this point because it's older technology and you got to have some more bells and whistles now. You know, people expect a lot more happening on a page. So I want to go back to it because I think it was a really good project. But I wasn't a web designer and didn't have somebody to design for me, so I basically taught myself HTML and did everything that was there, which, you know, it worked. Had links. It worked. There were pictures, you know, questions. Yeah. Its use was for introduction to using special, in other words, this is how you would do it. If you were going to go to a special collections, and I used that in my classes, I would have people, as a final project, you know, work with special collections for their final paper, you know, because I wanted to get them in there and realize that, you know, it's not something you can't do. It's something you can do. People get scared of it. It's like Josie is also taught in the program I did, a comprehensive studies program. The classes are 80-85% African American. And some of those kids, especially the ones that are from, like, you know, inner city Detroit, they've never been in a museum. So, you know, we've got them going in museums and making terms, you know, coming to terms with art that they see. And one kid, I'll never forget this. I mean, it'll be one of those moments you carry your whole life and say, if I never have another success as a teacher, this is enough. Kid came in to me and he said, I've never been in a museum before because I didn't think I belonged. You know, that's not where I belong. And he was like, God. And I found there was all these African-American artists in there. Whoa! And, I mean, he didn't stop there. He looked at all the other stuff, too. But for the first time in his life, he realized that it's your culture, damn it. You know? Take it. So I think I feel the same way about special collections, that there's a lot of cool stuff there, and I just want to see people feel like it's theirs. Anyway, I think we're out of time, and people probably need to go. Thanks a lot. Thank you for your patience.